From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Hardly anyone was watching, but on Saturday night in South Carolina, the nine Democratic presidential candidates held their first formal presidential debate. In case you've lost track of who's in the Dems race, they are John Kerry, Howard Dean, Bob Graham, Dick Gephardt, Joe Lieberman, Carol Moseley Braun, Dennis Kucinich, Al Sharpton, and John Edwards. They face a tough road ahead in their efforts to unseat President Bush, and before anyone gets a chance to take on the president, they all have to take on each other. Tonight on Point, the Democrat nine on parade and who brings what to the race for the White House. How do you think the Democrats will stack up against President Bush? Can one win? Who would give George Bush the toughest run for the money? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to begin tonight in Columbia, South Carolina, with 4 minutes of fascinating tape. In these excerpts, you'll hear moderator George Stephanopoulos from ABC News ask each of the candidates about their personal motivations for running and their character.
Senator Kerry, the rap on you is that you're just too aloof, that you don't have the common touch it takes to win.
I'm attracting support all across the country, and it's because, George, I'm talking about things that matter to people. I believe I bring strength to this ticket. Strength about how we maintain a military that is strong, but make ourselves stronger in the world. And I think I know what our vision is for this country at home. Health care, really leaving no child.
Senator Graham, Democrats like your resume, but they worry about your charisma. And what they think is that you're really running for vice president.
George, I am running to be the next president of the United States of America. One, they want someone with executive experience. Second, I am a centrist. I believe that you don't set policy from the end zones. You set policy from the 50-yard line and build out until you have a majority. Third.
And Senator Edwards, for you, what I'm hearing is the flip side of what I hear about Senator Graham. Plenty of charisma. But the Democrats I talk to fear that you don't have the policy depth and the policy experience.
What people are looking for in a president is someone who has the qualities of leadership. Strength, character, conviction, good judgment. I'm happy to have people judge me on that basis. Second, they want somebody who understands their lives. I did it first. It was 20 years as a lawyer and an advocate, and I've been doing it in the United States Senate, and I will be a champion for those very same people in the White House. And the American people
Governor
want
Dean,
somebody.
A lot of Democrats think that an anti-war governor with no national security experience simply cannot go toe-to-toe with President Bush.
First of all, I do have national security experience. Every single governor since September 11th has had to deal with security issues. I got into this race because this is the most conservative president of my lifetime, and because most of the people who are running up here either voted for or supported substantial tax cuts, voted for the No Child Left Behind bill, arguing about the Patient's Bill of Rights instead of putting forward plans early on. I want to change the Democratic Party. I want to change this country.
Ambassador Moseley Braun, here's what I keep hearing. You can't win. And the real reason you're running is to siphon votes away from Reverend Sharpton.
I've always had to run as a woman against the odds. When I was told I couldn't win for the United States Senate, I went ahead and did it. At the same time, I showed strength through it. I was the only African-American in the United States Senate, and one of the two, and I was assistant United States attorney. I've been breaking barriers down all of my life. I have a record of productivity that I think is second to none. And so,
Senator Lieberman, people think you're too nice to be president. And you're just not tough enough to take on President Bush.
You don't have to be a screamer to be tough. I supported the Gulf War. I supported the war against Saddam Hussein. My career shows that I'm ready to do the right thing for our country. That's what strength is all about.
Reverend Sharpton, two words, racial polarizer. And Democrats worry that every vote for you in the primaries and caucuses is going to cost the Democratic nominee votes in November.
That's the same charge that they gave Jesse Jackson 20 years ago. You have people that are waving the Confederate flag. They didn't wave it in Baghdad. They wave it in Columbia. And you would talk about I'm a racial polarizer because I say that we should treat people with equal protection under the law. I think the Republicans try to float that we can defeat that when all of us come together and have one standard. That's why
Congressman Gephardt, people fear this campaign's Bob Dole. A creature of Congress has been around the national track one too many times.
If you're looking for the fresh face and the new face, I'm probably not your candidate. If you're looking for somebody that has real experience over 27 years in the House, 13 years as Democratic leader on every domestic and foreign issue this country's faced, then I may be your candidate. The fight for working families.
Congressman Kucinich, the one time you had executive responsibility as mayor of Cleveland, the city went bankrupt. How do you respond to those who will say that you'll do for America what you did for Cleveland?
In Cleveland, that default ends up being a badge of honor for me because I stood up for the people of Cleveland against a takeover of our municipal electric system by a utility monopoly. Now imagine a president who's willing to stand up to the Enrons of America. Imagine a president who comes from the cities and will fight for working men and women. Today, people of Cleveland know that I did the right thing, and soon America will know that as well. Thank you.
The Democrat 9 being peppered with questions Saturday night in Columbia, South Carolina, to size up the Democrats' coming out party. We turn to two professional observers who were there. Joining me from Chevy Chase, Maryland, is Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for Time Magazine. Good evening and welcome, Karen.
Good evening.
And with us from Silver Spring, Maryland, John Harwood, political editor for The Wall Street Journal. Hello, John.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guests.
Karen Tumulty, take us in here first. What was your sense of what was on display in South Carolina on Saturday night? Was this an impressive roster of Democrats? Was this a roster of Democrats who have a chance to unseat George W. Bush?
Well, I think at this point those are two very different questions. But what I was most impressed by was that none of these guys came out of there sounding alike. They sounded very different, each staking out different territory. And I think this was less a chance to show off to the nation than it was a chance to tell Democrats, hey, it's time to start paying attention.
Mm-hmm. And John Harwood, in that speaking to Democrats, how did you see this gang breaking down? Are they all on the same page? Are they taking different strategic approaches to their base?
I think you can really take the six most serious candidates and divide them into three groups. You've got the sort of the wine and cheese primary between Howard Dean, the former governor of Vermont, and John Kerry of Massachusetts. These are both Northeasterners competing for kind of upscale liberal voters and fighting for that New Hampshire primary. You have the blue-collar populist primary between John Edwards of North Carolina and Dick Gephardt of Missouri, both of whom have been arguing about who has the more common folks' roots in their family background, and this is why Edwards went after Dick Gephardt's health care plan and said that he was helping out Enron at the expense of working class families. And then you've got a centrist contest between Joe Lieberman, who had an exceptionally good night, and Bob Graham, who is just entering the race, hasn't made a deep impression so far, didn't have a breakout performance in the debate the other night. So you have three of those mini contests within within the overall contest, and that explains why, for example, that Howard Dean and John Kerry persisted in their quite personal argument, disagreement, a little bit of macho, if you want to say something, say it to my face kind of thing. And I think the field is going to sort out along those lines.
Let's hear a little bit of that chest thumping, bumping between Senators John Kerry and former Vermont Governor Howard Dean.
I think Governor Dean made a statement which I found quite extraordinary, and I still do. He said, America has to prepare for the day when we will not be the strongest military in the world. I mean, that's his statement. I didn't make it up. He said it. I disagree. I believe that a president of the United States has a solemn responsibility.
But does that mean he's not fit to serve?
I believe that anybody who thinks that they have to prepare for the day that we're not the strongest is preparing for a day when we have serious problems. And I think the world has proven, and we have proven, that there is a rationale for our containing the most powerful military on the face of the planet.
This is what Senator Kerry said in January in his Georgetown address. In a world growing more, not less, interdependent, unilateralism is a formula for isolation and shrinking influence. That is what I meant. I stick by that. No commander-in-chief would ever, and I am no exception, willingly allow our military influence to shrink. Unilateralism is a mistake. That's what I said for it. I think the senator made a mistake in criticizing it.
Jack Beatty, there, Senator Kerry and former Governor Howard Dean going at it. There were some stings in there back and forth that we didn't hear there. Maybe you've got those.
We got into the issue of, I'm John Kerry. I have medals. I stand up.
Vietnam War hero.
Yeah, you don't say that. Don't impugn
my courage.
Absolutely. I was a little disappointed in Kerry's performance. First of all, his voice was yet cold. But he just didn't show any flexibility on the war issue. There's a way of being, you know, generally for the war that allows you to say, keep up with Tim Russert. It's saying something when a mainstream journalist seems more critical of the Bush administration than a Democratic candidate, especially in regard to the, no weapons of mass destruction have been found. Did the Bush administration, was this a propaganda manipulation of the country? The Shia possibility that we could be harboring, a Frankenstein's monster there of a Shiite state, at least Howard Dean mentioned that. And the cost that this is going to entail. So Kerry didn't seem to be even nuancing his feelings about the war as if he wanted to say, I'm the guy who's, I'm for the war wholeheartedly.
And the man who John Harwood sees as maybe walking away with the night as much as anyone did, Joe Lieberman, quite the contrary, was very supportive of President Bush's policy on the war. Let's listen.
The squabble between Howard Dean and John Kerry may make interesting political theater, but it doesn't send the right message to the voters about our party. Our party and the American people have an important choice to make in the next year and a half or 2 years. And the fact is, they're not going to choose anyone who sends a message that is other than strength on defense and homeland security. The Bible says that if the sound of the trumpet be uncertain, who will follow into battle? And I'm afraid this debate sends an uncertain message.
Is it the debate or is it Governor Dean's statement? What are you really saying here?
I think that both have sent an uncertain message, one in principled opposition to the war, Governor Dean, the other an ambivalence about the war, which will not give the people confidence about our party's willingness to make the tough decisions to protect their security in a world after September 11th.
Joe Lieberman on Saturday night indicating he won't waffle on the war. Karen Tumulty, how would you frame the basic challenge for these Democratic contenders, early on as it is, in going after President George W. Bush? What is the party? What are the candidates? What will the final winner of this inter-party struggle be up against in George Bush?
Well, I think before you have to step back a bit and remember just exactly where the Democratic Party is at this moment. It's a party that is in a sort of political form of post-traumatic stress syndrome that comes from having simultaneously lost both Bill Clinton and that excruciating 2000 election. So the party itself is in very much of an identity crisis. So they are looking to a nominee even before he takes on George Bush directly to really redefine the party, to sort of lead them back to, what exactly is a Democrat here. In the space of 3 years, we have gone from the rallying cry of the party being, we are all new Democrats now, in reference to the fact that, Bill Clinton had really set the party on a centrist path, to the fact that Howard Dean's surest applause line is, I'm here to represent the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. So even before they can take on George Bush, there's going to be a lot of sorting out to do.
John Harwood, how do you see that sorting out proceeding? Do you have a gut sense of whether it's going to sort out toward the centrist Joe Lieberman, the blue-collar Edwards Gebhardt, the wine and cheese, Dean Kerry?
I think if you had to lay money down, you'd say that the odds are greater that the party is going to place its chips toward the left rather than toward the center. There are a couple of reasons for this. One is that there's a lot of pent-up anger within the party at George W. Bush, a bit of it from the 2000 election, a bit of it from the fact that he's governed much more conservatively than many people expected and more effectively in some ways, and a third from sort of the sense that this is a guy who is just doing a lot better than he ought to be doing and isn't that smart and isn't that capable. Democrats ought to beat him. I think a lot of Democrats want to fight with George W. Bush. So my sense is that primary voters are more likely to gravitate toward a candidate who conveys the demeanor of getting ready to take him on. This is why
take him on in a big way. Please stand by, John. We're going to take a short break here. We have to. We're talking tonight about the 9 Democratic presidential hopefuls and their first formal debate in Columbia, South Carolina. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the 9 Democratic presidential hopefuls, 9, and their first formal debate Saturday night in Columbia, South Carolina. Most of America did not hear it. We're giving you sampling, some excerpts tonight, and something to chew on early on. What's your early sense of the Democratic field? Who's your early candidate and why? How do you think these candidates stack up against George W. Bush? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight, Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for Time Magazine, and John Harwood, political editor for The Wall Street Journal, both were in Columbia, South Carolina, feeling the heat, feeling the moment Saturday night. We're also joined tonight by our own Jack Beattie. You can join us as well, 1-800-423-8255. Let's hear a bit more from Saturday night when John Edwards and Dick Gephardt got into it over Dick Gephardt's health care plan.
To me, this is what it feels like. It feels like saying, you're in good hands with Enron. We will trust you. We will trust corporate America to do what's right for its workers, to make sure they're taken care of, even though they're already covering people. And the other thing is, Congressman Gephardt, and I've heard very little discussion about this, no one's talking about cost. What if we can't deal with the health care crisis in America unless we have the backbone and courage to do what I have been doing my entire life, fighting against big corporations, pharmaceutical companies, big insurance companies, big HMOs. There's a culture in why the president works for those people. There's a culture in Washington that stands against taking them on.
Let me stop you right there. You have just made a very, very tough charge against Congressman Gephardt. He said taking money from working people. So you think his plan is a tax increase on working people?
I think it takes money directly out of the pockets of working people.
And gives it to corporations.
I know it gives it to corporations.
Congressman Gephardt?
Well, I couldn't disagree with John more. I respect his views, but he's wrong on my plan. Let's look at two of the things he brought up. He talked about cost. I will save 5-7% a year off of the premiums that people are paying now for health care because we'll finally take care of this problem of uncompensated care. Secondly, he says, I'm raising taxes on ordinary Americans. That's the furthest thing from the truth. I am ensuring people are not going to lose their health insurance. I've been all over this country. People say to me all the time, I'm worried I'm going to lose my health care, even though I have it. Lastly, people get their health insurance from corporations. My plan requires everybody, every company who gets the 60% credit to pass it along to their employees and to offer their employees plans. This is not helping the corporation. This is helping corporations give people the thing they most need, which is health insurance.
North Carolina Senator John Edwards going after Dick Gephardt's recently released health care plan, saying it sounds like something that Enron might provide, and Missouri's Dick Gephardt coming back in response. John Harwood, fill this picture in for us a bit here, that what Gephardt has put forward is still fairly new. People may not know the outline of it. Give us the shorthand for what Gephardt's proposing in health care, and why would Edwards be coming back calling it an Enron plan?
His basic idea is to expand health care coverage in the framework of the existing employer-provided system. And how he would do that is to take all of the money that President Bush would devote to tax cuts, not just the 2001 tax cut that's been enacted, but the one that he's now proposed and fighting for on Capitol Hill. Mm-hmm. Take that money and devote it to various ways, but the biggest chunk of the money would go to increasing the tax deduction that companies now get for providing health insurance. If you're a company that does not now provide health insurance, you would be required to accept this credit. It would convert the deduction to a credit. It's complicated,
okay,
but it's a lot of money. You'd be required to accept it and to offer health insurance to your workers. If you already provide health coverage for your employees, which most big companies do, you would not have to change what you're doing, but you'd have to preserve what you're doing. This is where Edwards attacked him. He said that for the big companies that already provide health insurance, Gephardt is just putting money in their pocket, and he's getting it from working people by repealing the Bush tax cuts. Hmm. Now, there's an element of truth to this, but what Gephardt is arguing is that, yes, I'm repealing those tax cuts, but I'm providing something to people who don't have it now, mm-hmm. and the money that we give to corporations will both, who already provide it, will stimulate the economy and ensure that those companies keep offering health insurance.
Jack Beatty, repealing tax cuts and providing health care sounds like meat and potato Democratic kind of proposal. How do you interpret Edwards' attack here?
Well, it doesn't sound like, if I might just set it up with Gephardt, just to sort of put that in context, what we see here is the progressive restoration. Throughout the Clinton years, progressives around the American Prospect and the other few places where they write complained that the Clinton fetish, the Clinton emphasis on deficit reduction, was putting the Democrats in the position of having to clean up after Republican tax cut debauches. And that inevitably, in doing that, you have to raise taxes, as President Clinton did, and you have to cut spending, as President Clinton did. And you don't have a chance, although he tried, to expand the electorate by coming up with new programs because your whole emphasis is on, frugality and running a balanced budget. Well, Gephardt has basically said that's not the debate here. The debate is I'm going to accept deficits for as long as Bush will. But instead of my deficits going to represent tax cuts basically for the wealthy, overwhelmingly, I'm going to insure everybody in America. And by the way, I'm also going to have a covert wage subsidy built into that because companies that get the 60% deduction will have more money, presumably, available to pay workers and collective bargaining and so on. So it's going to be an issue of deficit versus deficit rather than frugality versus deficit, my spending and my health care versus your tax cut.
Karen Tumulty, is that how you see it? Does this create an open season for deficit spending where Democrats, the handcuffs are off again now? If President Bush is open to deficits through tax cuts, Democrats can be open to them through spending on social programs.
I'm not sure that the entire party is ready to move there. The fact is that Congressman Gephardt, basically his health care plan is the one big idea that's on the table now. But I don't think that a lot of Democrats, and particularly centrist Democrats, are ready to give up the fiscal discipline argument against President Bush. So what you hear from most of the other candidates, and Howard Dean, is, for instance, is going to be unveiling his plan fairly soon, is they say they could do it a lot cheaper than Dick Gephardt does it, that it wouldn't be as sweeping, that it wouldn't really reward companies that are already doing the right thing as they see it by their employees. So I do not think that the Democratic Party as a whole at this point is really ready to walk away from the deficit reduction high ground.
And Karen, John Howard,
a very important point, which is that by converting it to an argument about priorities, Democrats advantage themselves. And I think that even if other Democratic candidates don't go as far as Dick Gephardt does, I think they're going to move in that direction. And this will set up the struggle with centrist Lieberman and Graham, for example, trying to make that fiscal responsibility argument. Let's see what the appeal of that argument is when it gets before Democratic primary voters.
So it's going to be a lot about where primary voters in the Democratic Party find themselves, their heads, obviously, this time. Michael's calling from Boston. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure.
I'm calling actually to take exception with Mr. Harwood's original characterization of the field as breaking down into three groups and his marginalizing of Braun and Sharpton.
Mostly Braun and Al Sharpton. Okay.
Yeah. And I think he contributes to what's wrong with the entire primary system and indeed the whole political debate in our country because he characterizes people as wine and cheese liberals or centrist this or centrist that. What bothered me about the entire debate was the complete absence of any real discussion of real ideals or ideas in terms of what the Democratic Party might actually stand for. And people got very caught up in the mechanisms of health care and debates about those kinds of logistical decisions. There was very little discussion of real ideas about what is the Democratic Party.
So, Michael, it sounds like you caught it on C-SPAN and you didn't see the big muscular conversation you'd like to see there about fundamental principles.
Yeah, there really wasn't. And, in fact, the only people, I felt the only person, there's two people who spoke to ideas were Lieberman from what I consider to be the right wing of the Democratic Party and not the party I'd vote for, and Sharpton, who actually was willing to take issue with the real underlying cost of the war in Iraq that was so misguided.
Michael, I think we've got it. We take your characterization. Let's listen to a bit. Thanks for your call, Michael. Let's listen to a bit of Al Sharpton right here, and we'll come back and pick up your point, Michael. Here's Al Sharpton.
There's a time and place for everything, a time for war and a time for peace. We should not just, quote, go into war. There's also a time to build. And I think the question is how we have a president that believes in universal health care in Iraq but doesn't believe in it in South Carolina. How he believes in rebuilding Baghdad, but he doesn't believe in rebuilding Greenville. And I don't think that we are sending the wrong signal to say that Americans ought to be concerned about that. I'm proposing a $250 billion infrastructure redevelopment plan. I think Americans have the right to know that we're going to rebuild America. And while we're seeing these closed-bidded contracts given to his friends, I think it takes courage to raise those questions as well.
Reverend Al Sharpton speaking in Columbia, South Carolina, Saturday night. We're talking about the 9 Democratic presidential hopefuls in their first formal debate. You can join us. Who do you think would give George Bush the toughest run for the money in this group? Is anybody in this gang speaking to you? Who, why, and what's the big message that Democrats should be communicating? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Jack Beatty, what about Michael's complaint that he doesn't hear the big kind of characterizations and principles and issues being laid out there? It sounds workmanlike to him, if I may.
I think that was a very perceptive point. The candidates seemed more concerned with sort of policy details and with signaling positioning rather than just coming straight out and saying what it means to be a Democrat in the age of Bush and where the party needs to find its identity. And, you know, we're the party of such and such and so, and we're going to... There was none of that. And of course, it's right at the level of ideas and ideals that the President Bush is going to come out strongly on the other side with Republican ideas and especially ideals, freedom, God, country. Mm.
Karen Timmeldy, what do you make of that? We do have in the White House this big simplifying leader, and many people see it as a strength. Others are driven mad with, complain about it. But what does that suggest to the Democratic Party? Smart technocrat problem solvers, or that they need a big simplifying leader in response to George Bush?
Well, of course, the last smart technocrat problem solver they nominated, Michael Dukakis, didn't exactly do too well with the general electorate. And so it's...
But then I don't know where you put Bill Clinton in between those two polls.
Here's what Bill Clinton did. And this, in fact, was the example, Tom, I was going to use as sort of the way this process works. It sort of builds as you're selecting a nominee to where you ultimately select somebody's philosophy of governing. And what Bill Clinton did was back in the fall of 1991, he gave 3 big speeches at Georgetown University where he talked about literally scores of policies. And he did a very skillful job in those speeches, you know, much further along in the process than we are at this moment, but he did a very skillful job in giving you a philosophy of governing. Now, he could have just been hammering at the first President Bush on the economy, which was very weak at that time, but he didn't do that. He realized that what a Democrat also has to do is put out a vision of how they would do it differently. And that, I believe, is we're at the very beginning of that process.
How they would do it differently. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Mary's calling from Bedford, Massachusetts. Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I kind of like Howard Dean. I like the positions he takes, and I like that he's been very consistent in his positions.
And he's not afraid of big ideas, if I may say so.
He really is not. Unfortunately, I got the impression last night that the other candidates just didn't like him. I've seen him in person, and he is on fire. He excites the crowd. People are very excited, seem very excited about him, about what he has to say. And I see him having a lot of popular support. But I wonder if the Democratic Party would ever support his candidacy and if he could ever get the nomination without that, similar to, John McCain's situation with the Republican Party.
Yeah,
I just did not get the impression that the other candidates treated him with the reverence and respect that they did each other.
You can feel your question right there in the room, Mary, and certainly that prickliness. Thanks for your call. John Harwood, how about it? Is there an especially cold shoulder for Howard Dean? Why, on the basis of what he's said? And what about how he's positioned as a former Vermont governor? Does he have a fighting chance?
I think he does. He's especially disliked by John Kerry because John Kerry all of a sudden sees a great big roadblock to his plans for winning the New Hampshire primary. I think the caller raises a very interesting point, and it's a point that Howard Dean's campaign manager raised with me after the debate. He said, you know, a lot of the other candidates were complaining that Howard Dean came across in the debate as nasty and mean in his disagreement with John Kerry. He said, look, journalists may think he looks mean and other candidates may think he looks mean, but when Democratic activists see him talk, they go bananas. When he has appeared on television, the internet lights up with donations.
So is he getting a cold shoulder because he appears to be stepping up to the bigger issues than the rest of them, or because he's seen as an interloper?
Well, he is attacking senior figures in the Democratic Party for not having fought Bush hard enough. Mm-hmm. So that's one reason why he's gotten under their skin. I do think I would take issue with the caller in one respect. It's not those other Democratic candidates who are going to decide if Howard Dean gets nominated. They don't control it. It's the voters who do. And certainly governors have done very, very well in this process. The questions about Dean, I think, have revolved largely around what kind of a base he has. And coming from Vermont, it's not exactly a rich source of campaign contributions. So I don't think the fact that he is an outsider or a governor is a bar to him running. He's got to get some momentum in this process, and he's certainly shown the capacity to do it.
Karen Timothy, what about it, the chemistry there in Columbia?
Well, I think there's a personal dimension to it as well, and part of that is the fact that Howard Dean has not only been most aggressive about criticizing the others, but he has said a number of things about the others that were not true. For instance, when he was addressing the California Democratic Convention, he accused John Edwards of trying to have it both ways on the Iraq War. Well, the fact is, John Edwards had just only minutes before stood in front of that group and was booed because he wasn't trying to have it both ways on the war. And a couple of weeks ago, he accused Dick Gephardt of having supported the Bush tax cuts. Well, Dick Gephardt fought very hard against the Bush tax cuts when it mattered, which is before they were enacted into law. And so these guys have seen him not only come after them much more aggressively than any other candidate, but also has said some things that, in their view, it just aren't fair.
Put them together, and there may be a cold shoulder out there. We're talking this hour about the 9 presidential candidate hopefuls, that is, in the Democratic Party, and their first formal debate. You can join the conversation. Does the country want a smart problem solver or a big simplifying leader? What are the issues guiding you early in this campaign? Security, economy, health care, schools. Can the Democrats take back the White House in 2004? How? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the 9 Democratic presidential hopefuls and their first formal debate. It was Saturday night in Columbia, South Carolina. Of course, South Carolina will have one of the very early primaries in the run-up to the 2004 election. You can join the conversation tonight. How do you think these candidates stack up against George W. Bush? Is anybody in this gang speaking to you? Who and why? And what's the big message that Democrats should be communicating in the run-up to 2004? My guests tonight are Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for Time magazine, and John Harwood, political editor for The Wall Street Journal. We heard earlier from a number of candidates. Let's hear a bit more from Carol Moseley Braun. Here she is, just a bit of her sharing her concerns about civil liberties under the Bush administration.
We have to take very seriously the assault on our civil liberties that this Ashcroft, this Bush administration has begun, and that frankly Congress opened the door for with the Patriot Act. That act has arguably violates the First, the Fourth, the Fifth, the Sixth, the Eighth, and the 14th Amendments of the Constitution, have opened the door to emails being tapped and phones being tapped and searches and people disappearing in this country for the first time. I really think we are have a real crisis in America when it comes to our civil liberties, and I do hope that this act will be repealed, and I hope that we will all take very seriously rolling back some of the assault on privacy.
Former Illinois Senator Chicago's Carol Mosley Braun Saturday night in Columbia, South Carolina. John Harwood, you left three of these nine out of your initial lineup of who counts here, who are serious contenders, and that was, of course, Carol Mosley Braun, Mr. Sharpton, and Mr. Kucinich. What do you think of the role those three played on Saturday, the role that they're likely to play as the campaign unfolds?
They all did reasonably well the other night, but I don't think they're going to play a large role in the campaign at all other than appearing on stage for these debates. I haven't talked to anyone who follows politics, or voters for that matter, who think that any of those three have a reasonable prospect for winning the nomination or winning election. And I don't think the ideas that they're bringing to the fore, and I know the caller disagrees with me called it a while ago. I don't think they bring ideas that are all that substantively different from those of other candidates in the race.
Karen Tumulty, what's your sense of the effect of these three outliers?
Well, on the one hand, having them there is sort of healthy in that, you know, Carol Mosley Braun did in fact put forward the most eloquent arguments on civil liberties. And it was Dennis Kucinich who kept coming back to trade, you know, talking about the issues that wouldn't necessarily be on the front burner. But I think the real question mark here is Al Sharpton, who has a very checkered history and does not, in the eyes of a lot of people, have the legitimacy that would put him on that stage alongside those other candidates. And I do, and at the same time, and I think John would agree, that was a far more subdued performance than we've seen out of him at other events. He very often, you know, takes up a lot of the oxygen, has the best applause lines. And I have a feeling at some point, and maybe not in the too distant future, you're going to see one of these other Democrats take a whack at him on stage.
I agree with Karen thought that Sharpton did a good job of sort of keeping his head down in that respect in this particular debate, preserving his invitations to future forums. But I do think somebody at some point will find a convenient time for one of those sister soldier moments that Bill Clinton made famous a few years ago and go after Sharpton.
Although Al Sharpton keeps popping up no matter how many times he gets knocked down. Tom's
right.
Calling from Appleton, Wisconsin. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi. You know, it's nine politicians. I don't see a single statesman in the lot. And I would think that the Democratic Party, as an organization, could come up with two or three really focused people for us to choose from.
Tom, what exactly do you mean when you don't see a statesman? I mean, Joe Lieberman would like to stand up to that kind of characterization. I'm sure that John Kerry would like to see himself in those terms and others as well. What's missing in your book?
Well, you know, Lieberman, we're never going to have a first lady whose name is Hadassah. I'm sorry.
You're saying because he's Jewish?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that is not going to happen. So why are he and Sharpton wasting the airspace and the time so that all the people turn off their televisions and say, this is the same old, same old?
I understand what you're saying, but I want to get at the nub of it. Are you saying, talking about same old, that what they need is one serious white Christian candidate? Is that what it boils down to for you? And are you sure that's still the case?
Unfortunately, that is the case. I don't necessarily believe that that race or religion should have anything to do with it, but it does. And we need to get a focused message across, and that's not happening with the people who are out there.
Tom, we've got it. Thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, what do you make of that? Of course, the debate in Columbia was put off until something like 9 p.m. so that Joe Lieberman could come out of his Sabbath to be there without breaking the rules on the religious side. Joe Lieberman has not taken grief for being Jewish by and large. He was a very well-received vice presidential candidate. But Tom is saying, if you see Al Sharpton, Joe Lieberman, that they're just not the mold that he sees as standing up and ultimately winning.
Well, I certainly would agree about Sharpton. No one thinks he has a chance. But after all, Senator Lieberman is leading in the polls nationally. He's leading in the polls in South Carolina. And he was the only, it seems to me, he showed the most intelligence there. He kept sort of justifying his candidacy, and he made a nice gesture toward the electorate in South Carolina, which for Democrats is predominantly African-American, and was, you know, reminding him that he had gone south and worked to register voters, that he had been to the march with Dr. King, and that he was very pleased that for once in the white bread primaries that have dominated the Democratic sky, Iowa or New Hampshire, for once, one of the early primaries is going to be a state where there are a lot of African-American voters, and he was making a gesture to them. And as to this business about statesmen, I mean, my gosh, George W. Bush, when he debated McCain, he looked like a deer in the headlights. I mean, he was clearly just wanted to stop talking so he wouldn't make a mistake. He was frightened of his shadow. So I don't know about this. I think a lot of this is contextual. Once you see the nominee, once he's on the stage with George Bush, he draws even, no matter who he is.
Karen Timothy, let me put the Joe Lieberman question to you. John F. Kennedy, of course, broke the Roman Catholic taboo and became president. Joe Lieberman has a long political career where he's managed this without a problem. Is it ultimately a problem in the presidential race in your mind or not?
Well, if I could just make another point, though, before that. At this point in the process in 1991, Bill Clinton didn't exactly look like a thoroughbred either.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I think we've seen a pretty good road test of Joe Lieberman. He's already been on the ticket, and Al Gore still says that was the best decision that he made during his campaign. Mm-hmm. So, yes, there are going to be pockets of the country, I think, where his being Jewish is going to hurt him. But you know what? There are pockets where it helps.
Yep. And John Harwood, what about Tom's larger characterization? He's saying he just doesn't see candidates cut from the right stuff here. Is that always the case early on in the campaign, that it takes time and kind of a media absorption before anybody looks like they've got the right stature? Or is there something missing here?
Well, it depends on who's looking, but I don't really agree with the caller. I think Democrats have a reasonable choice between capable politicians who have been tested electorally, been tested through service in government. Howard Dean had successful terms as governor of Vermont. John Edwards is the least tested of the major candidates, but he won election in a very difficult state for Democrats. Dick Gephardt has been a national leader for quite a long time, and is a capable guy. You can agree with his ideas or disagree with him, but he's a capable public servant. And I think one would say the same thing of John Kerry and Bob Graham. So, what's a statesman? Who's a statesman? You always have this early period, as Karen mentioned before, where people look at fields and they look, oh, how small they are and how unpresidential they are. As was said a moment ago, when a nominee gets chosen, they grow in a hurry, and I think Americans are likely to have a pretty decent choice.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's get a real quick bit of Bob Graham talking about a geographic issue in this race.
John and I happen to be Southerners. Who have been the last three democratically elected presidents? Lyndon Johnson from Texas, Jimmy Carter from Georgia, and Bill Clinton from Arkansas. That says something about what it takes to be elected.
John Edwards and Bob Graham as the Southerners. Jack Beatty, the geographic issue in this race.
It is an important issue. I may be wrong, but I believe there are 144 electoral votes in the southern states, counting the border states. And the fact is that Democrats have not won unless they have been competitive in at least a few of those states. So the argument from the South is a very powerful one. The trouble is that the early prime, well, in a way, South Carolina provides the opening for that, doesn't it? I mean, a southern candidate could who didn't do well in Iowa or New Hampshire could come out of
South Carolina looking pretty well. The trouble is, it's just not something that voters in other parts of the country usually think about. You know, they don't say to themselves, "Is this guy a Southerner?"
Yeah. We got that. I want to dive right back in with a little bit more from closing remarks from John Edwards, John Kerry, and Joe Lieberman.
I'm running for president because I believe this president has betrayed people like my parents and the people I grew up with. People who work hard every day, try to do the right thing, act responsibly, and build a better lives for themselves and their families. Just because you speak the language of regular Americans does not mean your agenda is not the agenda of corporate America. Just because you walk around on a ranch in Texas with a big belt buckle doesn't mean you understand and stand up for rural America. I believe we can build a better life for our families, families like the family I grew up with, and communities like Seneca and Robbins, North Carolina. But it has to be based on the values of hard work and responsibility, not accounting tricks and corporate greed.
35 years ago, next month, I was on a ship returning to the coast of California from my first tour of duty in Vietnam. And the first crackling of the radio that I heard brought the news of Robert Kennedy's victory and then assassination. That moment was seared in me, as were the words of the poet that he quoted so often. Some men see things as they are and ask why. I dream things that never were and ask why not. I'm running for President of the United States because I really believe it is time for this country to ask again, why not? Why not, in the richest country on the face of the planet, health care for all of our citizens accessible and affordable? Why not early childhood education so that all of our children get the best start in life?
These are tough times for the American people. They need a strong new leader to take this country forward. They deserve not an either-or choice in November of 2004 between a president who's strong in the world and a candidate for president who is strong here at home. They deserve strength in both, and that's what I offer. I am the one Democrat who can match George Bush in the areas where many think he's strong, defense and moral values, and beat him where he is weak on the economy and his divisive right-wing social agenda.
Closing remarks from John Edwards, John Kerry, and Joe Lieberman. We've just got a couple of minutes left. Karen Tumulty, did you see a contender, more than one contender, in this crowd?
I think that at least, you know, a handful of these guys showed themselves to have what it takes to at least, you know, get to the table here.
So you think they could step right up? John Harwood, how about you? Did you see a contender? And what do you think is the most potent message that contender could bring to that table with George Bush?
I think Democrats have several contenders. George Bush is likely to win the election. That has to be stipulated from the start. Most presidents who run for re-election win. But it's probably going to be a close election, trading within a narrow range of votes. Democrats are going to have a chance. They're going to need to fire up their own base and be acceptable enough to swing voters that they can get to 51%. I think there are several candidates in that field with the capacity to do that.
So there's the makings of a race. Karen Tumulty, John Harwood, thank you so much to you both for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
My pleasure.
Karen Tumulty is national political correspondent for Time Magazine, and John Harwood is political editor for The Wall Street Journal. Jack Beattie, how did you come away feeling?
Well, you know, I was just glad to hear people talking about solving problems in ways that just weren't exhausted by the possibility of having tax cuts. I mean, that's all we've heard for President Bush, really. Everything has tax cuts as its solution. They were talking about other things, for education and health care. And they didn't talk nonstop about war. I mean, they seemed to be offering some other vision. And it was just good to hear that politics is about more than just war and tax cuts.
There seems a fair chance that voters might be ready to hear that. George Bush, of course, may develop some other planks as well in time for the campaign. Jack Beattie, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.